I can't believe I have to apologize again this year for my computer. Last year I started up my computer in the sort of meantime, in the 5 minutes before, and it came up with a little Windows icon and I got a big boo. Because last year was really my introduction to linux.conf.au, and the year before that was really my introduction to free software at all. So now I try to use open document stuff on a Mac and it just all goes haywire. So I apologize, it won't look as pretty as it should, but yeah, I wasn't relying much on the slides anyway. All right. I promised to talk about legal developments that affect free and open source software. Because there's lots of them, I am going to need to do it in a kind of overview way. I will touch on a whole lot of different legal issues. I am more than happy, of course, to descend into excruciating detail, as lawyers always are, in the question time. If you have any issues about clarification, you don't understand what I'm saying as I'm going along, please do feel free to interrupt me, put your hand up. If you have a question of substance about the law, though, I would ask you to save it for the end. Because it's very easy to get sidetracked once we start talking about the law. Now, I'm going to do this in a quasi-chronological way. I'm going to talk about what some of the legal issues and legal battles we've just been talking about have been, and why we can see them as almost past debates now. And then I'll move on to what's happening now and give you some thoughts about the future. For those of you who saw me speak last year, the essential message is actually going to be very similar, which is actually something a bit like this. You know, don't stop what you are doing, in general, unless you're doing something really bad, but you know, don't obsess about law reform and changes to the law. Because your best protection always during law reform processes is success. You know, if you are coding well and you are doing cool things, people will go out of their way to protect you. And we've actually seen that over the last 12 months or so. So that's the essential message. And I'll explain a bit more as I go along. So we have to start with the past, as I said, in order to kind of fit this general structure that I've set up. And I'm going to talk first about copyright. Now, it's hard to believe this, but we've been talking about DRM and anti-circumvention law now for 10 years. Digital Millennium Copyright Act was passed by the US Congress in 1998. So this has been an ongoing debate we've had, the extent to which the law impacts on our ability to play with content, and the law supports copyright owners' attempts to lock down and control digital use of content. What anti-circumvention law does. Now, in the last 12 months or so, you would have seen repeated this kind of meme that DRM is dead. And, you know, by implication, that anti-circumvention law has become irrelevant. And this has largely been generated by things like the decision of EMI to start selling DRM-free tracks on iTunes, decision by basically all four of the major record studios to sell DRM-free tracks on Amazon.com. And so we have this shift away from using DRM, it seems, and, you know, of course everyone goes, ding dong, the witch is dead, isn't this fantastic? Would be lovely if that were true. I think reports of DRM's death are, of course, exaggerated. And I base that on two essential points. One is that it is the music industry that we have seen moving away. And the music industry were never that good at DRM anyway, because all through their attempts to use digital restrictions management, they've been selling CDs, which could be ripped, unprotected digital files. Now, if you show me the movie industry going DRM-free, or subscription television going DRM-free, then we can start talking about the death of DRM. Now, you might be thinking, well, why does she have this still in the past part? And the reason for that is because the debate about law, the legal developments in this area, have kind of stopped. Particularly in Australia and the US, we now have very, very strong digital protection laws, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the US, very similar legislation here in Australia that basically bans any kind of circumvention and any device that can do circumvention. If you're a New Zealander in the room, don't worry, you'll have such wonderful laws soon, it would appear. Canada is currently having a debate about it. They will probably end up with a very similar model. The way things have been going internationally is a kind of convergence on a number of fairly strong anti-circumvention law models. So the legal developments in this space have kind of stalled, and I'm not expecting major changes in the near future. Now, still thinking about the past, it would be a little remiss in a talk about the law not to mention the release of the new GPL, which has happened in the last 12 months. GPL version 3, of course, a response by the Free Software Foundation to various developments that occurred in the years since GPL version 2. In particular, of course, you know, most of you will be familiar with this, we have the anti-DMCA clause that purports to declare that any free software or GPL version 3 software which is used to convey copyright works cannot be a technological protection measure and therefore will not be protected by the DMCA. The anti-TiVoization clause, there's an ugly word. This is, of course, the attempt to deal with TiVo-style compliance with GPL version 2. This, of course, is where you have hardware which will only work with the unmodified version of the software. So you still can modify the software and play with it as much as you like, but the modified version won't actually work on the device. This is a kind of false freedom, according to the Free Software Foundation. There's a clause that aims to prevent that sort of conduct. And then you have the anti-software patents clauses, specifically a license from contributors, a license from redistributors to any necessary patents, and a further part which was aimed at the Microsoft Novell deal, which aims to prevent people from engaging in discriminatory patent licensing. Now, this license, of course, is now out there, and it will face two tests. One is a market test. Is it accepted? Is it used? Is it implemented? The other is a legal test. Will this actually stand up when it comes to any legal disputes that might arise? Now, on some of the legal points, I do have my doubts. And I'm quite happy to get into some of the detail of that, particularly with the anti-DMCA clause. But I'm quite happy to get into the detail of that in questions if anyone has them. But for the moment, I'll just move on because there is much else to talk about. Now, I'm still talking about the past. And I hesitated about this slide because I thought, do I really want at an open source software to say the fight to kill software patents is over? Am I going to get lynched? That's a slight exaggeration. I don't think the fight is over, but I don't think you're going to kill software patents. I'm aware, of course, of things like the End Software Patents Coalition, which has serious funding to try and fight software patents. I'm aware that there have been noises in the US Supreme Court, but there's never been a US Supreme Court decision supporting software patents. However, there are two major problems you have with trying to kill software patents. That's one of them. That's the number of granted software patents in the US by year. According to one study, up to about 2002, you can't quite see the end of it, I apologise for that. So this isn't cumulative, this is just the number each year. If it was cumulative, it would look even steeper. There's a lot of them. And think about it. Every one of those, you know, cost in the five figures to apply for and to get. Every one has renewal fees that are being paid for. The amount of investment in here, just in those figures, is enormous. And that's the sort of thing you have to tear down software patents. Not easy. Now, the second thing about this graph that you might notice if you kind of clued into the software patent debate is where it starts. And this hints at the second problem. You know, the big software patent cases were in the 1980s, 1990s, you might recall. But in this study, they identified software patents going back to the 1970s. The thing is, it's really hard to draw lines here between one form of technology and another. And I know you can try, but patent lawyers are clever, and they tend to draft around them. I mean, we know that the European Union has a limitation on software patents. You cannot patent software as such. Every study that's ever been done in the EU of the situation finds thousands of software patents despite that ban, despite that explicit prohibition. So it's just, you know, you're fighting against some really difficult things if you want to try and kill software patents entirely. So that's why I say the fight to kill software patents is kind of past, because I don't think it's going to happen. It could in the future, and the fight, I'm sure, will continue. But there are many other ways to try and deal with what's going on in the patent area, and I'll come to those in a minute. Now, I want to move on to the present now. What are people talking about now? And the first thing I'll talk about is copyright. Again, I'll go back. Now, imagine you're a copyright owner and, you know, DRM isn't working and you've tried suing the grannies and the kids and the occasional responsible adult, 20,000 of them over in the US for downloading, and the downloading is continuing. None of this is working. What do? You try to shift responsibility to someone else. And at the moment, the favoured target is ISPs. This is the front cover of the International Federation of Phonograms, IFPI, their digital music report released in the last couple of weeks. By the way, just as an aside, who was the marketing genius who went revolution, innovation, responsibility? Can't you just see the, you know, the posters now? Please revolt responsibly. It's just weird, isn't it? But do you know who they're referring to? Someone else's responsibility to enforce copyright, specifically the ISPs. And if you needed any further emphasis on it, there's this page, which is the very second page of the Digital Music Report. This is the executive summary, making ISP responsibility a reality in 2008. There's only one acceptable moment for ISPs to take responsibility for protecting content. That moment is now. So that's where we're having a bit of a debate now. Now, what are we actually talking about in terms of responsibility? Oh, actually, there's one more thing. This is Paul McGuinness, the manager of U2, gave a speech just recently in the last couple of weeks making exactly the same point. It is time for ISPs to become real partners. And if they won't cooperate voluntarily, we need legislation to require them to cooperate. Again, really weird choice of language, isn't it? In cooperation, you sort of think, yeah, you know, being friendly and, you know, doing things together. We're going to force you to work together, is the idea here. Now, what specifically are we talking about? There's two related global pushes going on at the moment in copyright. One is notice and terminate. Or if you want to put it more politely, notice and disconnect. This is the push towards making ISPs disconnect infringing users, repeat infringers. The proposal that is being put forward in a multitude of forums is that the recording industry or the movie industry would inform ISPs of the IP address of an uploader. Warning notices would be sent to the account holder, and if infringement continued, the internet service would be terminated. That account would be terminated. Now, of course, you and I can see all sorts of problems with this, right? You know, how many people are using this particular account? How do you control your housemate? Do you have a responsibility to control your housemate when they're doing naughty things with the connection? Can you even guarantee that a warning will be received by the right person? No, there are difficult issues in making this sort of thing work. And of course, you know, the copyright owners say, oh, well, you know, it's not actually preventing kids from learning because they can just get internet service with someone else. So why are we terminating them in the first place? It's like we want to make things more inconvenient for infringers. They get terminated, they have to go to another ISP. Let's hope you have one, but you're not living in a remote area. So this is a push. Don't underestimate the power of this push. Now, MIPI at the moment in Australia is issuing press release after press release. They're talking to the media, they're talking to government. They really, really want this. France, they actually managed to convince the president to move in this direction legally. The IFPI report pushes it. There have been rumours that the same push is going on in Canada. So that's one aspect. The other aspect, is filters. Actual ISP level filtering of copyright infringing content. Now I know you're laughing, right? But think back to the very first keynote you heard in the main part of this conference, you know, and the disconnect between reality, you know, actually achieving things and the appearance of achieving things. The same applies in law, always, in policy making. Governments like to look like they're achieving things. Even if it doesn't actually work, they might well still want to put this sort of law in place. And again, in France, you know, there has been a discussion of imposing filtering. AT&T have been talking about it. There was a panel discussion on it at the Consumer Electronics Show this year. People are talking about this. Seriously. And this is just an aside for the Australians in the room. You know, Americans, you can just relax for a minute. You've got this thing called the First Amendment. Wish we had one. In Australia, we're facing content filtering of a porn kind, as in, we are waiting in February the details of Senator Stephen Conroy's plans for filtering the internet for inappropriate content at an ISP level. He has indicated an intention to legislate in that area. He's not coming up with any details. It's not clear yet whether he's talking about a blacklist of really nasty child porn sites or something more extensive. But my personal favourite sort of policy link that is drawn here actually is in when the copyright people get together with the porn idea and say, if you filter for porn, if you make it harder to get access to legitimate porn, people will go for the infringing stuff. So if you're going to filter for porn, you need to filter for copyright infringing material as well. Wow! I can see why these lawyers get paid a lot. That's a fantastic argument. Ars Technica called 2008 the year of the filter. People are talking about this. Worth keeping an eye on. Just quickly, a couple of other things. License compatibility. In licensing area, now that we have a GPL version 3, there's been some discussion of license compatibility, particularly between CC licenses and the GFDL. The idea being that you'll be able to re-license material, existing material under the GFDL into the CC system. Again, something I'm willing to answer questions on, but I won't go into now. Now, what's happening in patents? Well, 2007 was the year that patents actually came home a little. People got bolshy. We actually had litigation filed against FOSS providers. We had one lawsuit filed by the well-known patent troll Acacia against Red Hat and Novell. We had another lawsuit filed by NetApps against Sun in relation to the ZFS file system. Too early to say where that litigation is going, but it is interesting. Sun have retaliated big time. They've filed a countersuit with just about every patent they could find that might be relevant. They've aggressively gone for re-examination of the patents that have been sued on, which in some ways might be a good sign if they're willing to really go out to protect material that they've put out under the CDDL license. But too early to say where this litigation is going. In terms of other patent developments, there's movement in the US, which will probably improve the patent system in time. The KSR decision is a decision of the US Supreme Court. It raised the bar for obviousness, in short. It made it easier to argue that a patent that a patented invention was obvious and therefore invalid. This applies to all existing patents. This is a good thing. And it applies to newly applied for patents. The response has been that the USPTO is knocking back more patents. The acceptance rate has gone down. This might improve matters in about 15 years for you guys. But, you know, it's nice. It's a move forward. There's also a US patent reform bill. It contains some useful provisions, amongst other things, apportionment of damages. So you couldn't get a damages award for the full value of a product where the patent related to one small component of it, if this goes forward. Confining willful infringement, confining the triple damages that can currently be awarded for willful infringement, so that it is not enough to simply know about the patent or have read it, but you would actually have to sort of deliberately copy or have received a notice from the patent owner before you could be held liable for willful infringement. This would be good because it would mean people could read patents again. That would be nice. Well, not nice for anyone who has to read the patents. But, you know, generally good for, you know, knowledge and all of that. And post-grant review, expanded opportunities to challenge the validity of patents. All of this might improve the US patent system somewhat over time. It's not going to deal with the fact that there are a lot of bad patents out there already. It might reduce the incentives for patent trolls to go for the big treble damages awards. But again, you know, it's not going to change the world yet. And that's why these privately organised workarounds are important. Patent pledges, companies pledging that they will not enforce against open source or that they will actively defend open source with their patents if open source or free software is threatened. Peer-to-peer patent, which is attempting to use people reading patents that are applied for in a community kind of way. And the Public Patent Foundation, perhaps more importantly, Dan Ravisher and his excellent work over in the States, actually challenging bad patents that he is told are holding back development or research. Now, he's taking anonymous tips, he's taking information about patents that are holding back development, and he's actively going out seeking re-examination, and he's had some success. This sort of thing is a great workaround for dealing with the problems that we have immediately. I apologise for the appearance of this slide. So what can we say overall in terms of the legal developments? I think one thing we can say is that the issues that are facing FOSS now are slightly less straightforward than they were. They're getting more complicated. DRM is, it's really easy to explain the problem with DRM, it locks up content. Once you get into filters, network access, it gets less visible. With the patent, it's easy to argue for killing software patents entirely. But the move we are seeing is towards more detailed engagement with the patent system to deal with the things as they are now. So actually challenging patents that are out there already, finding these private workarounds. The legal issues are getting more complex. Now, in some ways, this is a good thing. It's a sign of maturity of the FOSS development. You know, people are suing FOSS for patent infringement because FOSS is more important now. The legal issues are getting more complex because you're more involved in business. This is all great. What should you all do about it? Not much, for the most part. Code. Keep coding well, because there's nothing more depressing as a lawyer than reading Slashdot. I joke, but the as I say, winning these sorts of battles, battles over filters or network access, battles over software patents and challenging software patents, and getting the patent reforms that you need takes allies, allies with money. Allies with money come when you code well. And because the legal issues are getting harder, you're going to have to rely on your representatives more, your representative bodies. People like Dan Ravisher in the Public Patent Foundation, the Software Freedom Law Centre. They're dealing with the problems in an upfront way. So I hope what I've been able to do is give you an overview of what's going on in the IP world and the legal world as it affects FOSS. I'm more than happy to take as many questions as you like, but I would emphasise again, don't let concerns about these law reform and these bigger picture issues stop you from doing what you do well. Because there's lots of very, very smart people thinking about these issues and addressing them in a real way. You can help, but don't let it dominate your life. Otherwise, you'll put me out of a job. No, thank you. And are there any questions? Certainly. So the question was, I'm an academic, how do I publish something that might infringe on a patent in the US? So are we talking about code?
I'm talking about mathematical algorithms.
Publication per se without application is unlikely to get you into too much trouble.
With a company in code.
Sorry?
With a company in code, I could sense code.
So actual application of the patented ideas. Simple answer is with risk.
Keep
coding. In these circumstances, it's very much a matter of risk assessment. You know, what is your risk of being sued for what you are doing? What is the likely outcome if you are sued? You know, are they likely to be able to get serious damages from you? What would you do if you received a cease and desist? Because, you know, I mean, I can't tell you to go out and do lots of illegal things. That would be... Actually, I did kind of just do that, didn't I?
That's why I'm challenging.
Yeah, no, look, that's a fair question. Legal questions are always a question of risk assessment. You know, if you're seriously concerned about a possible patent infringement, then you do have to talk to a lawyer about it. I can't give you legal advice on that. But I guess what I'm saying is, if the risk is low that you're likely to be sued, I mean, you know, free and open source software people do things all the time that they know risk patent infringement. To a certain extent, you have to rely on things like the patent pledges, things like the private foundations that are coming to the aid of people who are threatened in this area. So I guess the brief answer is do a risk assessment. Consider whether you're at serious risk of losing your house. Be careful, but don't let it, you know, don't sit there and think, oh, I've got to go and, you know, do patent searches and things like that, work out whether I'm infringing, and then I can act.
Because I was thinking of just talking to the IP people at the university and having some strategy, university-wide, start dealing with this thing because it's immense.
And I think that's a great idea. Talk to the smart people. Talk to the lawyers. Yes.
What, in that case, in the case of an academic paper published with company code, what would be their argument to get damages? What would the other side be saying?
Well, yes, of course. Sorry. In a case of an academic paper, the question was, in the case of an academic paper which is published and put out there, what is the argument for damages? Small. You know, if you're not out there and selling things, then the damages that they can actually get from you is likely to be small. But if they can say that you are in some way competing or detracting from their market, the harm that is caused to them is something they can seek to recover in damages. Depends on the case. It really does. It depends on the individual case. That's why if you have a serious question or a serious risk, that's why you do talk to a lawyer and work out what the potential damage is and what the potential cost is, which all goes into your risk assessment. I probably should have done the, you know, I am a lawyer, but I am not your lawyer. So, you know, consider that the usual disclaimer. Yes. Red. Yeah. Yes.
Could you comment about patent, if there's any action being taken on patent pre-birthing? So sort of the patent's about to expire, the tweak will be reapplied, then you can patent for about 25 years.
Rebirthing or evergreening of patents.
Is that a significant problem for us? And is there anything big about that?
So the question is patent evergreening or rebirthing? This is where the patent, you know, gets to the end of the life, you try to make a few tweaks, you try to get an extra patent to extend the patent monopoly. Is this a serious problem for us, meaning FOSS, and is anything being done about it? The short answer is, as far as I'm aware, what is being done about evergreening at the moment is mostly study to see whether it is really a problem. Because there's a lot of talk about evergreening, and there are some cases where it could be said to have happened in the pharmaceutical area in the US, but I'm not aware of any large-scale study which shows that it is actually occurring in other technology areas or that it is a significant problem at the moment. Yes. Okay, so the question is basically, with these issues being more complex and, as you say, being taken in effect away from the public eye into negotiations, or, you know, and in circumstances where the legal issues are such that it's hard to get a groundswell of support, what can someone do if they do have the time and the inclination to get involved? Simple things like writing about it and awareness raising is the sort of thing that I do, you know, when I blog about these issues and talk to the media about it to try and raise some awareness. There's awareness raising, there's acting through representative bodies. So, I mean, representative bodies like Linux Australia, like the Consumers Association and the like. These are the sorts of associations that governments do actually pay attention to in these debates. And working through those associations with other potential allies, you know, organisations like Google and the like. One of the really positive things we've seen in the last 12 months in Australia is some of these companies like Google, like MySpace, like 9MSN actually have policy people now in Australia. So working with allies like that on these issues. But, you know, I have 10 minutes. Excellent. So I guess that's really the only guidance I can give you. I guess my main point, I guess, is don't obsess about it. Yes. Yes, that's you sitting in the back. Red.
Yeah. I guess,
Look, I guess I was making the talk, I was asked, the organisations I was talking about are largely American. Is there anyone involved here? Just a clarification, are you talking about the copyright owners' organisations or the sort of challenger forces of good and light organisations?
Forces of good and light.
Forces of good and light. Yes, there are people who do amazing things here in Australia. I'm not aware of anyone who's actually going out and challenging patents per se in Australia, but I mean, we do know that the one-click patent re-examination occurred because of some work one guy was doing in New Zealand. So it's not confined to the US, but the fact is that they have foundations that fund, you know, people to do this kind of work over in America. Tim. So the question is, if a patent is successfully challenged in one country, is the result transferable here, or does it make it cheaper to challenge the patent here? The result is not directly transferable. Now, challenging the patent successfully in the US will not mean that the patent automatically gets struck off here in Australia, for example. You can seek to challenge the validity of patents in each country where it matters to you. And you might find that if they have lost the patent in one major market, they care about it less, which might make it a less expensive process. And you can, of course, cite the same prior art in multiple places. And so you are, there are economies of scale in doing this. But unfortunately, or fortunately, we don't have a global patent system at the moment. That means that you do actually have to challenge it in jurisdictions where it matters. The most obvious one usually is in the US. Up the back, sort of a yellow or khaki.
Yes.
In general, it is the person exploiting the patent who will be liable for patent infringement. Exploiting means, selling the patented product, using the patented invention, or the like. So potentially, it could be a whole bunch of people. If you are if you are acting as an employee, usually liability will lie with the employer. To go back one step. The question usually is who ends up getting sued. Single university students working on projects within universities are highly unlikely to be sued. Universities might get sued. That's why their lawyers worry when you start, talking about infringing patents. Companies can get sued. That's why, the patent troll Acacia sued Novell and Red Hat, because they actually have some money to make it worthwhile. Patent litigation is expensive. It's not lightly brought. More questions? Yes. I think jury's still out on how much change we'll see. We have an interesting situation at the moment where I guess you have to divide it up. In relation to porn, unfortunately, the reliance on a family first senator takes us back to the days of Brian Harradine. That means that that's why we have Stephen Conroy coming out and saying we want to restrict people's access to material. We've already seen some movement in that direction. In relation to copyright, I'm pretty sure that you could confidently say no government is going to want to go near too much copyright reform for at least another couple of years, because we went through a three-year process of very extensive reform. There have been some suggestions from meetings that there have been, some constructive engagement with the FOSS community already by members of the ALP. I guess we'll just have to see what comes out of that. That's the best I can do at this stage, yes. They have asked for submissions on one quite specific point in relation to private copying of movies and private copying, I think it's of images. This was an undertaking that the government made when they underwent some copyright reform at the end of 2006. Here in Australia, we got things like rights to make private copies, particularly of sound recordings, because there was such this disjunct between reality and what people, you know, what the law said should be doing, what everyone was actually doing, like, using iPods. At that time, they undertook to review the movie situation, because people were saying, we'd like to back up movies, because my toddler keeps destroying them. The government said, a bit too early to do anything, we'll review that in 2 years. 2 years is really 1 year, they've asked for submissions now. I think because there hasn't been much major movement in the market, I'd be surprised to see them do much dramatic. My guess would be they'll say, circumstances haven't changed, we'll review it sometime in the future. But if you have evidence that it's really important to be able to make these private copies, by all means make a submission. How am I going? 4 minutes, yes.
I may be wrong, but I understand Australian copyright law is constrained or at least made to align with the US law because of the free trade agreement with America.
Correct.
Is there anything similar in patent law? Or is Australia free to go its own way?
The question was, since Australian copyright law is very much constrained by the US Free Trade Agreement, is the same true of patent law? Now, are we significantly constrained in the way we develop patent law? The short answer is the Free Trade Agreement was much less detailed on patent law than it was on copyright. Clearly, the copyright lobbyists were stronger in the USTR because they've got very detailed provisions in there. That said, our Patent Office so far has not shown much inclination to diverge. Our law has been developing in fairly similar ways. There is a provision in the Free Trade Agreement which requires us to try to harmonise law and practice. It's a fairly meaningless commitment, to be honest. So the short answer is we are not as constrained in the way we develop our law, but patent law tends to move more slowly in any event, at least when it comes to legislation. The real concern in Australia in patent law is that our patent office is granting patents left, right and centre. Yeah, that was an innovation patent. Someone did get a patent for the wheel. That was an innovation patent. They're not examined before they're granted. I think he eventually withdrew it, John Keogh, you know, because he was making a farce of the system. Nice lawyer guy. The real concern is that our patent office actually grants patents as readily as the US did before the KSR decision. There are studies which actually show this, and I'm not aware of any changes that are likely. Right at the back there.
Mm-hmm. No modern theory of economics says monopolies are a good idea. So why are not all patents in Australia, in our system, subject to competition?
For not promoting commerce. Mainly because why aren't patents unconstitutional in Australia? Because they, you know, the Constitution says they must promote commerce. Short answer is whether they promote commerce, in fact, is a decision for the executive, not for the courts. That's a policy decision. The executive has made that decision to support a patent system. We've committed ourselves to various treaties to continue to do that. No successful constitutional challenge will be made to that. And I'm not even a constitutional lawyer, but I do know that. Last question.
Mm-hmm.
scaling efforts that have, you know, very simplistic view, distorted by the people who do own those media channels and support.
Well, the question is there anything we can do about sort of misinformation about filtering and whether it's a good thing? And, you know, the fact that there are all these emotional appeals made to protecting kids every time someone wants to filter for, say, copyright infringement, how that works. The reality is people don't vote for individual laws. So yes, you can always go out there and inform the people around you, and that's a good thing. And, you know, you can write about this and inform people that way. And if you have access to blogs and things like that, you can absolutely inform people. Even more importantly, you can perhaps inform them about why filters are a bad thing, what they actually stop, and what they stop that matters monetarily, you know, that actually has an economic cost to Australia. That sort of thing can be talked about. I'm told I can't take any more questions. We are wrapping up the talk. I, however, will be around all of the rest of today, and I will be around at, you know, open free day, whatever it is, tomorrow. So please feel free to come and grab me, pigeonhole me, tell me I'm wrong, ask me what to do, not ask me for legal advice. And thank you for your patience.